Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will you face the final months of your life? How would you help a family member or a close friend cope with a fatal illness? While advances in medical science allow many Americans to push thoughts of terminal disease out of mind for years on end, the reality is that most of us will eventually be called on to help care for a loved one facing the end of life. Palliative care focuses on comforting a dying patient when a cure becomes impossible. Pain medication, of course, is an important part of the equation, but as pioneers in this emerging field can explain, its benefits go far beyond relief from physical discomforts. Dr. Mark Casanova is Associate Medical Director of Baylor University Medical Center's Palliative Care Consultation Service. Registered nurse Min Patel is a full-time employee of the program, and reporter Lee Hancock recently profiled their work in a five-part series for the Dallas Morning News, which is available online. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Lee, how did you decide to cover this in such depth?
Well, I had a personal experience of a family member, my little brother, went through a long and serious illness and got great medical care. An acute care hospital in Memphis, just state of the art. But as we struggled, and particularly family members who were closer to him and closer to the hospital, tried to figure out what to do. I mean, you know, and I would go over and visit. I saw that everybody around the hospital bed suffered with trying to figure out what to do when a cure wasn't possible, how to help him live as well as possible. And this was a protracted illness that went on for about 5 years, and he was in ICU for most of the last year of his life. So as I went over and visited, it became apparent to me that there had to be a better way. And so I began looking into end-of-life care and very quickly came on to, you know, the information about palliative care was directed towards Baylor that was told had one of the best programs, not only in Dallas, but in the country, to look at a better way of doing end-of-life care. And, you know, through one thing and another, was able to spend months following them and learning about what palliative care was all about and how this better way actually could help people live better.
There's a really interesting quote in the piece, and I can't remember who it's from at this point, but it asks the question, you know, are you trying to prolong life or are you trying to prolong death? And the sort of the quality of care makes the difference there. Let's talk, Min, about what good palliative care is. Beyond pain management, having read this piece, there's so much more to it than people might imagine.
Good palliative care is really identifying a lot of patients, you know, that are in our facility and that have been, you know, maybe in the ICU or maybe on the floors that are really, you know, we are struggling to make better. And I think sometimes we forget that patients do come into our facility and we can't make everyone better, you know. And so identifying patients, I think, is really, you know, a big key to, you know, who can get palliative care. And then obviously advanced care planning, you know, and pain and symptom management, like you just pointed out. But advanced care planning is very important because some patients come into our facility, we know are on a, you know, maybe a downward trajectory of their illness. And somewhere along that illness, we have to kind of, you know, participate and say, hey, you know, what does this patient need now? You know, especially if we can't make their disease better, how can we transition them to a comfort plan of care? And that's really what myself and Dr. Casanova and the rest of our team do.
Dr. Casanova, what changes when a family can say out loud that a person is going to die?
Well, I think transitioning through the acceptance of that, and the key factor that changes is not just the acceptance of the inevitable mortality of our loved one and ultimately of ourselves, but it then allows that patient, that family, and their friends to focus on living. Okay, it's an acknowledgement that death is coming, but it gives them the opportunity to make plans, to take trips, to live life to the fullest. And that's really one of the key concepts of palliative care is, you know, I know people may read the piece or hear about it and think, well, gosh, that's really sad. Those nurses and physicians and therapists work with people who are dying. We look at it as working with people who are living and how can we help them live the fullest of their abilities within the context of their illness. So I think that acceptance on the part of the family is key and can really turn a corner for quality for the patient and the family.
Lee, I wonder if you were surprised by how much joy you found with these families, even at what most people would describe to be the most difficult times in their lives?
I was. And it was, at sometimes it was a wonderful thing to see how people could, you know, learn to reset their goals and focus on not going back and forth to the hospital or getting chemotherapy or getting treatments that sometimes, you know, when they can work, when they cure people, can be very, you know, difficult to bear, but they have a reason. You know, once folks could look at moving beyond those things that made life difficult, there was just amazing joy. There's an individual who was our last patient who passed away, Penny Bork, who talked about how much this freed her up to spend time with her 8-year-old daughter, to do the things that she wanted to do, to take trips and live life. And she said, in a way, she really didn't know until this team came and helped her how to do those things again. And so there was great joy for her and her entire family and other patients as well. I saw that over and over again.
We're talking this afternoon about palliative care with Dr. Mark Casanova of the Palliative Care Consultation Service at Baylor University Medical Center. Min Patel is an RN working for the same facility. And Lee Hancock is a reporter who did a 5-part series, which is now available online for the Dallas Morning News. Min, one of the things that I know that you really focus on is providing control for these people, which is such an interesting concept because they've lost control over the thing that most of us really would want to have the most control over. But there are places where they can take that back.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we really have to meet patients where they are in their illness and allow them to tell us, you know, what they're going through, you know, what they want as well. And so I think it's very important that we listen. And I think we do a lot of that. You know, we listen to what they have to say to us. And also we take cues from, you know, what they're asking, you know, and to, you know, allow families to participate in caring for that loved one, you know, while they're dying, or even while, like Lee had mentioned, Penny Bork. I mean, she very much wanted control over what was going on, and she wanted to leave a legacy for her child. And so we listened to her, and we intervened as a team and allowed her to do that, you know. We did a lot of journaling with her, you know, we got a lot of therapy for her child, and really focused on the most important goals that she had for herself, which was to be at home and to pass at home, but also to leave legacy for her child. And so we want patients and families to have control, absolutely.
How important, Dr. Casanova, is managing the expectations? You know, everyone has, oh, I don't know that everyone has it, but a lot of people might make a list of the things they want to do before the moment that they die. I would imagine some of those things are possible with a program like this, and some of them will not be possible.
Yeah, and really that's where getting sort of another opinion, if you will, in addition to the primary treatment team that is providing care for the patient, by bringing us in to provide a little bit additional information, or what we call prognostication, which is the ability to or the attempt to predict the time course for a patient and really the course and trajectory of their illness. And once we have a good sense of that, we can then help them prioritize goals and things to accomplish. It's also important, another thing that we do is educate them on what their future will look like, to talk very frankly about the last days, the last week, to talk to the family frankly about the last moments of death so that they know full well what they're going to see, and in doing so, it's not as scary. I think one of the inadvertent downsides of the modern medical complex that we've created is a picture of death that many of us are not familiar with. It's very foreign to us, and being able to re-educate our society on what a natural death looks like, I think, is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. How often do families get on board with this, and how often are families really the thing that you're working against?
Well, I think it's a mixture, and I wouldn't necessarily say that we're working against families, but certainly there are families who are in different stages of acceptance. And undoubtedly, there are cases that were called in by the primary treatment team for assistance when they feel that the family and or even the patient themselves don't quite understand the scope or the trajectory of their illness. Many times once we sit down and visit with these families and the patients, we realize they're much further along in their understanding and their coping than the primary care team realized. And it really just sort of boils down to conversations and communication styles. It also helps that we take a multidisciplinary approach. So it's not just myself walking in as a physician, yet another physician, a long line of physicians, or even men coming as a nurse, but we have our own dedicated chaplain. We have occupational therapists who practice complementary techniques such as Reiki and biothermal and meditation. We have our own chaplain, social workers, nutritionists, speech therapists to help patients and families in training with comfort feeding. So we take a sort of a broad multidisciplinary approach, which can help with those families. I think one other benefit we offer when talking about caring for the patient and the family unit, we also provide care to the treatment team. Many times they themselves are struggling emotionally with patients that they've cared for, sometimes years, decades, and they themselves are having an emotionally difficult time separating their own feelings and emotions about that patient and the treatments that they're providing, and sometimes just having us on board to burden some of that or shoulder some of that burden can be very helpful for them.
How important is it that you get someone to the stage of acceptance before they actually die or get their family to that place?
It's, in an ideal world, important. Do we accomplish it in every case we're involved in? No. Do we do better than not? Yes. We make an awful lot of headway, I think. If you look at studies in the palliative care literature and the medical literature as a whole, looking at institutions with palliative care programs, you'll find that our involvement does advance acceptance, does advance understanding of the disease state that the person is struggling with. It has shown to have increased quality of life and even in some studies, increased length of life by avoiding therapies or treatments that for those given individuals who have end-stage disease may not make the most sense and may actually shorten their lifespan.
And, you know, and I think Mark has a good point as well in the fact that, you know, we don't just always see patients just, you know, just before they die or a week before they die. Some patients we have followed for a long time. And so, you know, when it comes to acceptance, we can start introducing the concept of palliative care pretty early on in their illness. And really, that's what me and our team really want to do, so that it's not right to the end of life. We want to start preparing them as they go through their illness and the different stages of their illness. And they may have multiple admissions, you know, from the first time we visited with them, you know. And so our goal is to really start working with the families and the patients really early on in their illness. And so it's not always right towards the end or the week before they pass or 2 weeks before they pass. And so we have time to work with patients and families.
And I think also that the medical community and physicians notably need to understand that we've created part of the problem.
Absolutely.
As good as we are and as many advances as we've made, we've created a dichotomy. It's do everything or do nothing. And palliative care is working on bridging that.
We'll return in a minute to our discussion of palliative care. We have two professionals here from Baylor University Medical Center's Palliative Care Consultation Service. Also, reporter Lee Hancock with the Dallas Morning News, who has recently published a 5-part series. You can find that online. There's a link to it on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this afternoon about palliative care with Dr. Mark Casanova and our registered nurse, Min Patel, of Baylor University Medical Center's Palliative Care Consultation Service. Also, Dallas Morning News reporter Lee Hancock is here to talk about the series that she recently published. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. Lee, what did it take for you to convince families to let you follow them through this process?
Actually, I was pretty amazed at how open most people were. Not everybody. I mean, obviously, this is a, you know, a hard time for patients and their families, and you would think that they would, the last person they would want in the room is a stranger, particularly a stranger with a camera, because it wasn't just me. It was my colleague, Sonia Hebert, who came in and wanted to take still and video photography so we could document this fully and have videos and photographs as well as the words. But people have things to say at this stage. And many, many folks really felt like they could teach something. And I approached them in that manner, that they were going through something that the rest of us will. You know, one of the Baylor marketing people that I worked with, you know, said to me one day that the data is pretty clear on this stuff, that approximately one out of one of us are going to go through this at one stage or another. And so the people, not only the folks in the bed, but their family members really felt compelled to open up and show the rest of us, if you will, what they were experiencing, because they thought it could teach other folks and do good. So, you know, I probably, you know, 7 out of 10 folks said yes. And those who didn't, you know, certainly we, you know, didn't press or push, but we were very, very pleased and surprised, actually, at how many folks wanted to help.
I imagine that a lot of people look at you, Dr. Casanova and Min, and say, well, you do wonderful things, but I could never do that job. Do you think we all have it in us to help a person face the end of his or her life, someone that we really care about?
I think we all have it in us to do it from time to time or to step up to the plate, so to speak, and especially engage for a loved one. I think what we see are some folks who are blessed to not be exposed to too much of this. And they're lucky in many ways that they can make it through a significant length of their life and not have to face this. The counter is that I do think it takes a special type of personality to engage in this on a daily basis. I'm an outpatient internist, and so my day job is primary care and getting folks better and preventing serious illness. And then my late afternoon, evening, night job is helping folks who are in a different stage of their life. Min, on the other hand, kind of jumps into this waist deep day in, day out, and as do others who are involved in the field. So I think it is a special type of personality, but a needed personality, just like there's a unique personality to trauma surgeons. There's a unique personality to oncologists. I think it's vital that we all have our little quirks and idiosyncrasies that make this work.
And I think we all have a common link, too, in the fact that, you know, Dr. Casanova, myself, and the majority of our team, we've been through this. We've had our own personal experiences. And I think that, you know, I know for me, that is what drove me to what I do today. And so I think that we can see the family's perspective and the patient's perspective on the other side of the bed. You know, and I think that's really very, you know, that's been key for me, particularly because I can see where the families are coming from. I can, you know, understand, you know, what they're asking or what they're not asking. So I think we have a common thread. And so we've all had kind of similar experiences, too.
Does there come a point in doing this for a living where you stop reliving your loved one's death every single time you help a family go through it?
You know, I think that, you know, certain situations remind me and bring that back. Particularly, it did last week. You know, when I was caring for a patient who had the same disease as my brother did, and so that brought a bunch of memories back up. You know, but it also allows me to relate very well to what the family was asking and what they were experiencing, because it's very complicated. And so it does both, you know, and we try to provide the best, you know, care at that time that we can. And yes, it certainly does you know, we do relive some of the moments.
But I think it also can be very healing.
Yeah.
To engage in this type of endeavor, healing, you know, obviously for the patients and their families, but also healing for us as providers. You know, one of the other unique things that I think you'll find very commonly in palliative care practitioners, whether they be nurses, physicians, chaplains, or therapists, is the reward that we get in our work, in the sense that this is a situation where we have one shot to get it right. And if a person has a significant struggle as they die, or their dying process is not as comfortable as it could have been, that family's going to live with that death forever. And so we see this as not only a goal, but almost a healing process for ourselves and for our patients to make sure that we get it right and make sure we provide safe passage.
Is there always a trade-off still between alertness and pain relief?
Actually, you know, it's not as a significant problem as one may think. And you know, that's the other area of expertise that we carry is in pain management. Are there individuals who get sedated from their medications? Yes. But with time and adjustment to the medications, sedation typically wanes. We can also utilize different medications to help perk people up if they wish. There are some regrettable situations where an individual's pain is so severe that they require dosages that leave them quite sedated for the last hours or days of their life. But those are the vast minority of the patients. Many of our patients are fully awake, functioning, maybe not driving themselves to the office, but certainly awake and alert and living their lives on pain medications.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jeanette in Allen. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say thank you so much. I read every word of the article in the Dallas News, and my dad died when I was 4, and my cousin died of breast cancer last year, and she has 5 kids, and nobody told them that she was dying until like a week before she died, and I just really felt for those kids, and I felt it was very unfair, and I'm just grateful that you guys are making this, you know, doable for children.
Thanks very much for your call. That it does come across in the piece as something that is really a critical function. There are some families who just can't bring themselves to be the ones to tell their kids.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's where our team has really worked very hard in the last, you know, year, 2 years, so that, you know, parents, you know, should have guidance of what to tell their children and how. And also, we need to consider the age group of the children, too. You know, they could be teenagers, but on the other hand, they could be, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6-year-olds. And, you know, what parent knows what to tell a child, you know, because we don't think that, you know, we're ever going to have to tell our children that we're dying. And so, you know, we have really tried to work with the children and also meet the children where they are, you know, in their age group, because, you know, children grieve very differently. And so we have to make sure that, you know, we educate the parents as well where the child is in their grieving, and also, you know, to engage in the schools that they go to and make sure that their counselors at school know, you know, what's going on at home, and also provide a lot of literature and material for the parents as well on grief and counseling, and also where they can get those resources in the community.
Lee, you have a really extraordinary exchange in the article that I think most people won't witness until, you know, God forbid, they have to do it themselves. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about that? The little girl.
Michelle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michelle Bork. Yes. I mean, it was extraordinary. And
she's 8 years old.
She was 8 years old. Her mother, who just passed away this past week of ovarian cancer, and her father were really sensitive about preparing her and being very honest with her. Yet, you know, as Min said, you know, no one imagines that they could have to tell their child that they're going to die at that age. And so when it came time, they just couldn't find the words. So they the team brought in a child life specialist, although they're, you know, like everyone else, scrambling for funds to to pay for this kind of care. They brought in someone who does, you know, as she can, does work with the team and actually sat down with this little girl. And it was very apparent that Michelle knew. And as her parents said to me at some point outside the room from her, we feel like she's protecting us as much as we're protecting her. And I heard that from other people who deal with children, not only at Baylor, but around the country. Often, you know, kids are very aware and they're very, very sharp and they know what's going on. And sometimes the scariest thing for them is not to have any way to express themselves, to play through these things like kids do, and to have, you know, an adult to step in and say, look, this is going on and it's okay. And so I was able to watch an exchange with a child life specialist where she sat down with Michelle and she let her, you know, play a little bit and then read her a book called Mommy's Going to Heaven and was able to talk to her about the fact that her mother was going to die. And Michelle wanted to, you know, push back against that a little bit. And the child life specialist was very, very caring and careful. And then returned Michelle to her mom, and Michelle crawled in the bed with her mother and Penny read this book. And I think the moment that really moved me the most, and there were a lot of them in all of that, you know, I'm crying as I'm watching this, but at the end of the reading of the book, Michelle knew that, you know, her mother was upset and Penny was crying, and so she did what she could to protect her mom. She took the book and threw it across the room and said, okay, let's start coloring. But in that whole exchange, Michelle was allowed to be given the information, to deal with it in a way that an 8-year-old would find comfortable, and then move away from it. Because kids will kind of come back again and again, is what I was told and what I saw. And they may have to hear again and again. But with the work of this team and the people that they brought in and the work that child life specialists can do with kids like this, you know, they help explain to parents who, you know, they may have no idea or be grieving or be unsure. This is how you can teach kids and this is how you can show them. And they model this different way of helping kids to understand. So, you know, yes, I was able to watch just an amazing exchange with this kid where she was struggling with how do I deal with this and how do I accept it. And in the end, Michelle kept trying to tell people, no, my mom's not going to die. Mm-hmm. But then they allowed that, you know, that was okay too. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tom in Mansfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I find it quite interesting that we're having a discussion about life and death in the 21st century, and yet we've talked about or not talked about the spiritual aspect of it. And I've worked in healthcare for over 12 years as a chaplain with a large medical group here. And I can say as a chaplain, the role that we play with helping people get to that, the part where they're able to make peace, I think a lot of times it gets overlooked that the doctors deal with the medicine and the nurses with all the caring and all of the physical aspect, but there's a spiritual aspect and component of it that has to be spoken to, not in the sense of trying to proselytize people, but to speak to the deep needs of somebody's life meaning something. And I'd like to hear more about that. I hope that if you have these discussions in the future, that a trained professional, a chaplain, could be a part of the discussion, because I think a lot of times I've watched families struggle with how far they should go, what they should do, and a lot of it boils down to their faith and what their theological beliefs are.
Well, Tom, I'm very glad you brought this up, and it certainly is part of the program. It's available, the program, through Baylor, but we'll get some comments for you. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Tom, one of the things that interested me in watching this team, they had a very engaged chaplaincy program, not only the palliative chaplain, but there were other chaplains as well that worked very closely with men and the doctors and the other team members. But the sort of spiritual discussions that went on with patients and families weren't confined to the person, you know, with a collar, if you will, coming in the room. Every day when I saw Dr. Casanova interacting with patients, or Dr. Fine, or men, they were talking about God, about people's spiritual beliefs, about what, when they were talking about what folks might envision their death looking like, they talked an awful lot about the spiritual meaning and the religiosity of what was happening. So, you know, this was, it was almost a seamless part of the fabric of the team's work as they did this day in and day out. And, you know, that was one of the things that struck me very, very quickly in watching all of the team members work, not just the chaplains.
Yeah, one of the philosophies of palliative care, and one of the core key components of palliative care, is that it's multidisciplinary, meaning, of course, you have members from a variety of disciplines in healthcare, including, obviously, our chaplains and our spiritual leaders. But the other aspect of it is a transdisciplinary approach, meaning that we train our chaplains and our occupational therapist to be aware of the signs of pain, or be aware of the signs of a patient having difficulty breathing. And we educate ourselves and our fellow colleagues, or at least utilize our chaplains to educate us about the spiritual aspects of and the importance of that as a patient's life draws to an end. And I think it is sometimes, Tom, you're right, we overlook it and we may not speak to it, but it's an inherent component of everything we do. If this was nothing more than a physical transition, it would be very simple work. It's the fact that it's a spiritual transition that makes it that much more important. So I thank you for your comments.
We are talking about palliative care, especially regarding Baylor University Medical Center's palliative care consultation service with Dr. Mark Casanova and registered nurse Min Patel. Lee Hancock is here as well. She's just published a 5-part series in the Dallas Morning News, which you can find online. There's also a link to it on the Think page. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this afternoon about quality end-of-life care with registered nurse Min Patel and Dr. Mark Casanova of the Palliative Care Consultation Service at Baylor University Medical Center. Lee Hancock is here as well. She wrote a 5-part series on the issue in the Dallas Morning News, and it is still available online. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Dave in Fort Worth. Hi, Dave.
Hi, guys. Hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I'm standing at the door and clearing things out by taking care of my grandmother and my father. I helped with the assistance of doctors to keep them from having to be taken care of by professionals for 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm. That must have been really difficult.
It was very hard. I abandoned a career as a professional chef and hadn't got back online yet. Mm-hmm. But I buried two wonderful people that I loved, extended their life, and it would have gratefully sent them someplace where they needed to be, but where they really needed to be at that time was home, and not being butchered up by doctors and not being prescribed pills that make them numb and stuff like that.
So you had a hard time finding that, I guess.
Well, we cleared that forest. They died. They died suddenly but gracefully, mm-hmm. at home. So that happens sometimes, but I'm not denying that what everybody else offers is possible, but sometimes home is a good place to die.
Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
And if you look at studies, that's exactly what most of us express a desire is to be at home. At least 80% or greater of us say that if we had our choice, we'd be at home. Sadly, 75% of deaths in the United States occur in an institutionalized setting, whether it's a hospital or nursing home. So there is a better way. And with early interventions, with open discussions, with advanced care planning, it is possible to make that happen.
Would it make a difference if more medical care were provided at home? Because it seems that once people have decided that they're not going to aggressively treat an illness, that's the point at which they sort of go home. Is there any way to recraft the system so that you might receive care in the home before you're at the very end of your life?
Well, I'm not sure about recrafting, but one of the mechanisms that's already in place is hospice. And hospice care has similarities to palliative care, but there are a few key differences, one of them being the fact that with palliative care, you can continue to receive aggressive or what we would refer to as life-sustaining treatments, such as chemotherapy or certain medications, and certainly go to the hospital if needed for crisis care. But hospice does serve as an ability to care for individuals at home. The caller who just called in, his family were blessed to have him, and that's something we see a lot. Is we see patients in our hospitals and in our institutions who don't have families, or maybe don't have the support system if they do have families at home. Maybe the family is an elderly parent or an elderly spouse who's having difficulty themselves. So there are times where it is legitimately difficult to keep people at home, but it's oftentimes possible with enough time, enough planning, and enough creativity.
So you mentioned that everybody or the majority of Americans surveyed say they want to die at home if they can. I'm wondering how much information there is in the chasm between that and saying nothing that people ought to talk about before there's a crisis.
Well, I think there's a huge divide, and multiple parties are at fault. We were sort of reminiscing in the break on how many times you walk into a room, and when we broach the subject of why we're there, the person will blurt out, "Oh, well, you're here to talk to me about the fact that I'm dying and I have a terminal illness." And the physician who called us in said, I need your help with this patient. They don't understand what's going on. So I think just simply talking can close that gap, and more people kind of being informed of the services available through palliative care, through hospital social workers and care coordinators, and through the benefits of hospice.
One thing that's also important to remember is some of this doesn't take a professional. Some of this you don't have to have a doctor. Some of this just before there's a crisis. That's the best time to be talking about this, where you can state your wishes, whatever they may be. There are forms available. We have some online with our project. You can also go to the Texas Department of Health and get, living will forms and medical power of attorney. So you can fill out these forms and be, very open with family members about this is what I want. One of the most gratifying emails I got after the project ran was from a colleague who actually forwarded on an email from his mom, who said, "By the way, son, I've updated my living will, and this is what I want: A, B, C, and D. And I just want to be clear that you remember this, and it's in the safe deposit box. So, if anything happens, we're all clear." And, really, that's an amazing gift that the mom has just given him. There was also a lady that I talked to who was a hospice director down in Tampa who said they had kids that came in and volunteered from a high school in hospice, and they asked to have a dinner with their parents. And they had 14-year-olds who were standing up and telling their parents, "The biggest gift that you can give me is to be very clear on what you want, so when there's a crisis and you're older, I don't have to make those decisions." And then the 14 and 15-year-olds were sitting down with their parents and handing them these forms, and families were gathered around and filling these things out. So it's not something that you have to do in a doctor's office or in a hospital, or you have to do in a mournful and sad sort of way. It just takes making the effort to broach the subject. And it's surprising how open people will be once someone, whether it be at a holiday gathering or some other family gathering, will actually open up. Folks have very strong opinions about these. They just don't sometimes have a way to express them.
And we find that, when conversations like this haven't occurred, the family struggle tremendously because they say, "Gosh, we never talked about this. I don't know what my mom would want." And so just like Lee said, having the open, honest conversations around the kitchen table is what we do, is very important.
What do you suggest in families where one person does want to talk about it? Often it's an older person, but not always. And then the rest of the family says, oh, mom, oh, dad, come on, don't talk like that.
Nothing's going to happen. You're fine.
You know what I mean? People, everybody wants to sort of pretend that, and, sure. and it's a problem for people.
I think in that situation, it behooves that individual even more to fill out an advance directive or living will, make sure their physician has a copy of it, reattempt to have those conversations with their children later. Don't press it at that time. But in situations where you're not 100% sure that your loved ones or the proxies that you've chosen will follow through with your wishes, I think making sure that they're in writing and with your treatment team is very important.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Barbara in Grapevine. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Well, I have a couple of comments. I have had, and I consider it a privilege, to see three family members through end stage of their lives. My mother, who literally died in my arms, and my husband's grandparents, who lived with us, and we were very close to. And one of the things that helped me was... having read ahead of that time even, Kubler-Ross's book on death and dying. And so I was able to be very open with particularly my husband's grandfather. You know, what are your wishes? Do you want, you know, any advanced things done, all this kind of stuff? And it really helped me. And then my other thing was I used to work for a group of pediatricians, and one day a mother called in, and the child's grandfather had died. He was 7 years old, and she wanted to know if he should go to the funeral. And he said, well, you know, was he close with his grandfather? And she said, oh, yes, very. Saw him several times a week. And he said, well, then I think it would help him to go. And then he got off the phone and he turned to us and he said, you know, Victorian children knew all about death and nothing about sex. Now our kids know all about sex and nothing about death.
Yeah, that's so true. Barbara, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I guess once again, it's, you know, the more honest you can be, the better. Let's go next to Joy in Louisville. Hi, Joy.
Hello.
Hi, Joy.
Hello. I was just listening, and I'm a person who has been a recipient of the services that are offered at Baylor University. My husband was diagnosed in April and was gone. Sorry, in June, and that was a situation where we didn't have time to prepare because we were still talking about fighting. And so Dr. Casanova and his little assistant there,
Min Patel,
provided a very valuable service to our family, and I just wanted to call and say thank you.
Oh, Joy, I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for calling.
For us.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
How often do you have personal policies for yourselves about funerals? I know you must grow close to patients. I don't know if it's something that you set a rule of thumb about doing or not doing. How do you make those decisions?
Min, I'll let you answer.
You mean going to
You attend
to funerals,
or do you have to sort of focus on the next patient?
You know, I personally don't like to go. I think I'm one of these people that, gosh, I want to remember the patient as I saw them in the hospital and the conversations that, you know, we had and a lot of the joyous moments that we had. And so I kind of tend to shy away from funerals, and not just patient funerals. I tend to shy away from funerals in general. And so my thing is it's very rare that I'll attend a funeral.
Do you believe in heaven?
I do.
Do all of you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. That's got to be helpful when you're able to talk to a patient and sort of let them know that you're confident that they're going somewhere where there isn't any pain and there isn't any discomfort. Mm-hmm. Is it a problem when families have sort of different outlooks on what happens? Or is that another thing that they don't really discuss a lot with their dying relatives?
Outlooks on what happens in the afterlife?
Yeah.
We've seen the whole gamut. Again, getting back to, I believe it was Tom, the chaplain who called in earlier regarding some of the spiritual aspects of it. I think, you know, some of the difficult cases I've seen are patients themselves or family members who are convinced, who believe in heaven, but they believe they're going to hell. And those are difficult cases to work through and to kind of get to the root cause of those feelings and those emotions and those thoughts of what occurred in their life or what do they feel that they did that would cause them to not go to heaven, and getting them as best as we can, again, with the help of our chaplains, to find peace before they pass. Those are very difficult cases.
The way that the chaplains interact has been interesting to watch also, in that, you know, it is a Baptist-affiliated institution, but they walk into a room and find out the spiritual or the worldview of the person in the room and converse and act accordingly. One of the most beautiful stories that I heard about was there's a chaplain who's not on the team but works a lot with men, who was involved with the care of a Cambodian Buddhist family. And there was a desire on the part of the family to leave the body in the room for a period of time, not to be touched because of their religious beliefs. And so this very devout Southern Baptist chaplain very carefully made sure that this happened and you know, helped sort of stand watch to honor that religious worldview. So it's not a matter of, you know, going towards any one or the other faith. As Tom said, I think, as when he called in, this isn't a time to proselytize. And one of the beautiful things about watching these folks, and what I understand also happening with other palliative teams around the country, they go in, they address spiritual pain, which can be, as Dr. Casanova said, profound. But they don't go in of a mind to push one faith over another. It's more honoring the faith that a family and a patient has and trying to find ways to work within that faith and that worldview.
It was really striking to me, reading especially the descriptions of men at work, about how often your job is about breaking the rules. And I'm wondering when we'll get to a place where, not that you would do anything against general hospital policy,
but of course not.
When we'll get to a place where the rules allow for this, as opposed to having to be bent to care for people in the way that is necessary.
And, you know, we are hoping, you know, we are working on having our own palliative care unit at Baylor. And hopefully, I think by maybe 2010, Dr. Casanova,
2011.
You know, we're working on having our own unit so we can put a lot of these of our patients there. And so, you know, we can have more space. We can have the things that we need. And definitely more family members can be there, you know, and have accommodation so that, you know, we can have children there, pets there, you know, have our occupational therapies, work with meditation or Reiki or whatever. And so hopefully when we have our own unit, we can accomplish a lot of those things without breaking the rules.
I think we all hope for that with you. Yes. Thank you all so much. Registered nurse Min Patel and Dr. Mark Casanova both care for terminally ill patients at Baylor University Medical Center. Reporter Lee Hancock recently profiled their work in a 5-part series for the Dallas Morning News. You can find it online. There's a link to it on the Think page. It's been really great to have all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.